Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Welcome to Sunday School Dropouts, the podcast where an ex-Christian and a non-believing sort of Jew read all the way through the Bible for the first time, except we finished the Bible, so now we are looking at stories that seem like they should be in the Bible, but they aren't. I'm Lauren O'Neill.
And I'm Nico Bakulich.
And let's get biblical.
Relax, baby.
I'm very nervous. Do you know why I'm nervous?
Global warming?
Yes, but also because it's our 100th episode.
Oh, one hundo.
One hundo.
Or one a short hundred, as they call
centurion.
It.
Centurion. Did we prepare a special 100th episode for our listeners? No.
No, we did. But then we recorded it, and it was terrible. We threw it in the trash. So the greatest gift we can give to you, our listeners, consistent quality.
And definitely looking ahead at our calendar and figuring out important milestones and planning for them. Let's go over some ground rules. I'm the ex-Christian. I was raised Presbyterian. I'm now an atheist.
And I'm the non-believing sort of Jew. Also, this is not a Christian Bible study podcast.
And it's not appropriate for children.
I feel like that covers it. Do you want to move on
to
the topic at hand?
The topic at hand. Phew.
I'll put the drop there. I'll put a cool drop there.
Okay, thanks.
You'll hear some cool sounds. I'll definitely do this.
Okay,
note
great.
To myself later. Insert cool drop there. Okay, keep going.
Okay, ready? And it's drop. Noah!
I'll put in cheering noises here.
Cheering noises?
You heard what I said.
So, Noah, obviously, is in the real
Yeah, I was going to say, what
Bible.
The fuck, Lauren?
you were going to say, what the fuck?
Yeah, I was going to be like, you know, that's the thing that I was going to do. I was going to be like, what the fuck? You know, because we already know all about Noah.
You know, you think you know about Noah.
Mm-hmm. You think
you don't know.
God damn it.
There is a lot of, you know, because this is one of the oldest stories in the Bible, there's a lot of mythology built up around Noah.
Mm-hmm.
And so there is the stuff in the Bible, but there's a lot of extra stuff too.
Mm-hmm.
I do want to start with the canonical story of Noah from the book of Genesis. You know, everybody in the world has heard this story,
mm-hmm.
but if you actually look at the Bible, there are some interesting details that you probably didn't know about.
I'm into it. Let's do it.
Great. So,
this is your grandfather's Noah. Later we'll be talking about not your grandfather's Noah.
Mr. Noah. Just call him Noah.
All right.
Okay. He's the son of Lamech.
Mm-hmm.
He's the grandson of Methuselah.
Right.
You ever heard of him?
I think so, yeah.
And
I read about him in my history book.
He's the great-grandson of Enoch, who you can hear more about in our Enoch episode, as well as in our recent Archangel episode. By age 500, you know, still a spring chicken.
Yeah, where were you when you were 500?
Yeah, we all remember our 500th birthday. Noah had three sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. But what's important is that the world is getting very wicked around this time. You know, humans haven't been around that long.
Noah is the 10th generation out from Adam.
Yes, and you know, around this time, some evil fuck angels come down,
mm-hmm.
And they have sex with human women.
This is in the real Bible, just to point out.
In the real Bible, We've talked about them on many, many episodes because they also show up in Apocrypha, because like, if that's in the real Bible, how can you not create extra stories about it? But they create these cannibalistic giants known as Nephilim. And so then, according to Genesis 6:6, quote, "The Lord regretted that he had made human beings on the earth." So he decides...
We've all been there.
Yes. First, he decides to lower the human lifespan to a mere 120 years. Then he decides to send a giant flood and wipe out, along with most animals, all humans. Because, quote, "I regret that I have made them." Very vexing passage for, say, a young Christian named Lauren, who has been told that God is perfect and never changing, but somehow he regrets something, and it's very confusing. Anyway, he decides to spare Noah, because Noah is a righteous man. So he gives him these instructions on how to make a big triple-decker boat called an ark, and to take with him on the ark his wife, his sons, their wives, and several animals. The first instructions say to take two of every animal, a mating pair. But then the second set of instructions is to take seven pairs of every clean animal, seven pairs of every kind of bird, and then just one pair of every unclean animal. So like pigs and grasshoppers and stuff. Even though clean and unclean animals have not been established yet. They won't be established till the book of Leviticus.
Oh, we're going to talk all about that in a minute.
Can I just kind of slurp into the etymology corner for a second?
You, look, we can go there.
Okay.
But you can't slurp.
Oh, no. Okay. Etymology corner about the ark. The Hebrew word is not ark at all. It's tevet.
Oh.
And we translate it as ark, which is actually from the Latin word for a large box or chest. So that's why the Ark of the Covenant, which ends up holding the Ten Commandments, is also called an ark.
Even though it's not by, and this is just me, by my count, it's not a boat.
Right. Ark actually means a treasure chest. So this boat is like the treasure chest where God is keeping all
his true treasure, clean animals.
Yeah, and seven of each, and also a few unclean animals, and also Noah. Additionally, the Bible says the ark is supposed to be made out of gopher wood.
And nobody knows what gopher wood is, right?
Well,
they have
here's
guesses,
the thing.
But...
Yeah. So, like, I grew up as a kid picturing a gopher, right? Like a small burrowing mammal.
Sure.
And assumed that gopher wood was, you know, like found in the same habitat as a gopher, or maybe a gopher, you know, chewed on it or something. No. Turns out the original Hebrew says etze gopher, which is like the gopher tree. And it's just some Hebrew word that coincidentally sounds the same as the English word gopher. And nobody knows what it means. It's never used anywhere else in the Bible, and it's never been used anywhere else in any ancient texts that we found.
Sweet.
So it's just a gopher.
That does sort of make it difficult to build a period correct ark, right?
Yes. However,
I know a lot of people have tried.
Well, that's my last point, actually. Well, this isn't in the etymology corner. This is just in the...
Again, we can leave, but you can't slurp. Hey, hey.
Okay. There is a theme park in Kentucky called the Ark Encounter, created by notorious young earth creationist and all-around dumbass Ken Ham. It has a life-size ark built following the instructions in the Bible. You know, it's so-and-so cubits wide.
And what did the hammer choose
whatever.
For his wood?
I'm not sure what he chose for his wood, but just last month, there was a news story that the park had to sue their insurance company because it refused to pay for damages that were incurred during a flood. The ark did not stand up to a flood. So Noah builds the ark. He gets on board with his family and the animals. God makes it rain for 40 days and 40 nights, which kills every creature not on the boat except for the fish and stuff. Doesn't really go into saltwater versus freshwater fish, but we'll just assume they didn't know about that yet. As a kid, I thought, you know, 40 days and 40 nights, like I thought that was the whole ordeal. But actually it goes on much longer
because it
just stops raining after 40 days. But the flood lasts for 150 days. It keeps rising for 150 days. And then that's when God starts to make the waters go down. And the boat gets stranded on the top of Mount Ararat,
mm-hmm.
or the mountains of Ararat.
Right.
A region, perhaps. Mount Ararat is in, there's like one now that we still call Mount Ararat. It's in modern day Turkey. That's not necessarily the same mountain that's being referenced here. So 3 months after that, they're like stranded. And then the tops of other mountains start peaking. Noah sends out a raven. And it says the raven keeps flying back and forth because it can't find anywhere to land. Kind of ambiguous about what's going on with the raven. Like it's unclear to me if Noah can see the raven flying back and forth or if it's just gone and the narrator's just telling us that it's flying back and forth. But regardless, a week later, he sends out a dove. And the dove can't find anywhere to land, so it comes back. And then a week later, he sends it out again, and it can't land anywhere, but the water has receded enough that it finds an olive branch. And so it brings back the olive branch. And then a week later, he sends it out again, and it never comes back because now there's enough dry land that it doesn't need to come back. And so after like a year, like a full year on the ark.
Mm-hmm. 365 days, or in the lunar calendar, mm-hmm. a year and 11 days.
Damn. Noah and his family release all the animals. They get out. They make an offering to God using some of the clean animals and birds. Luckily, they had 7 pairs of each on hand.
Like God had thought ahead.
Yes. And then God promises, never again will I destroy all living creatures as I have done. And then he sends a rainbow to sort of sign the covenant. The covenant does also involve a couple
good one
rules.
For Pride Month.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Pride Month. We planned this.
Mm-hmm.
We planned this ahead of time. There are a couple of rules in the covenant, which are kind of a forerunner to the Ten Commandments. They involve like...
God says trans rights, by the way.
God does, TBH. But not in this passage. In this passage, he just says, don't eat the flesh of an animal that's still alive. Don't eat blood. Don't commit murder. And be fruitful and repopulate the earth. So now... Unfortunately, the first thing Noah does is plant a vineyard.
Mm-hmm.
And at some point in the near future, he gets turnt and passes out naked in his tent. Bad start to the new... This is like the one righteous man that was spared.
Mm-hmm.
So not a great start to the new world. But his son, Ham, famously, sees his father in his tent, passed out naked. And he goes and tells his brothers, Shem and Japheth. They get a garment and they walk into Noah's tent backwards, turning their heads away from his dick. And they lay the garment over him without seeing his shame.
Mm-hmm.
When Noah wakes up, he curses Ham for seeing his dick, but blesses Shem and Japheth. He actually technically curses Ham's son, Canaan.
Mm-hmm.
And he says that the descendants of Canaan should be the slaves of the descendants of Shem and Japheth. And then the Bible just cuts the story off there and just abruptly says Noah lived 350 more years. Don't know what happened during those centuries. And died at age 950, the end.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, Noah and his family are the only humans left alive. So logically, all humans are descended from them. So Genesis takes a little chapter to sketch out which like tribes or ethnic groups are descended from which brother. So Shem's descendants are the Shemites, and that's where we get the word Semite and Semitic. And his descendants include Abraham, and according to Luke 3:36, Jesus. Japheth's descendants are the Japhethites that they're just in there. Some they're in the mix.
Mm-hmm.
And then, because Ham was cursed due to the unfortunate dick accident, his descendants include the Cushites, a.k.a. Ethiopians, Egyptians, and Canaanites, all tribes that the Israelites are going to be enemies with later.
Mm-hmm.
And also one of his grandsons is Nimrod, a mighty hunter before the Lord, but also, frankly, a problematic fave.
Mm-hmm.
And you can hear more about him on our Nimrod episode.
Oddly, this idea of dividing the world into groups based on their relationship to Noah continues well into the 20th century.
I mean, we still use the word Semitic.
True, we do.
And we talk about, like, that's Semitic languages and...
But all of the, like, pseudoscientific racism of the late 19th century, early 20th century...
Yes.
...is fully on board with this.
Yes.
And they're like, oh, well, you know, phrenologically speaking, Hamites are
right.
like this.
Yes. We'll get into this more later. But so that's Noah in the Bible itself, in the book of Genesis, the canonical Bible. But, you know, starting very early, there's lots of folk tales about him. There's lots of extra stories about him in the Talmud, in various Midrashim.
Also, there are predecessor stories to Noah, of course.
Yes.
Because it's a story that was likely absorbed from other traditions.
Yes.
There are parallel versions of the Noah story that were recorded at nearly the same time with different details. It's a very rich tradition of a flood stories.
Yes. I mean, as I'm sure many of our listeners know, there are flood myths around the world.
Mm-hmm.
There's flood myths from Africa and the Americas and Australia, everywhere. But in particular, you know, the Mesopotamian epic of Atrahasis involves the god Ea Enki giving Atrahasis instructions on how to build an ark to survive a flood, and he hasn't put animals on it. And then when he gets off the ark, the first thing he does is make a sacrifice, et cetera, et cetera. The Epic of Gilgamesh is
right.
the closest.
Yeah, it's so similar.
Very similar. In the Epic of Gilgamesh, Gil goes to visit Utnapishtim,
mm-hmm.
who also survived a great flood. And this one's even more similar because he built an ark and put animals on it, and then the boat eventually landed on a mountain. He releases a dove, a raven, and a swallow. Again, the first thing he does after getting off the boat is to make a sacrifice. And also the goddess Ishtar says she'll never forget this moment and she'll never do this again.
Right.
Just like she'll never forget the shining necklace on her neck.
Exactly.
Clearly, like, very analogous to the rainbow.
The great thing about Utnapishtim is the gods destroy the world because humans are being too loud.
Yes, it has nothing to do with sin. They're just annoyed.
They're just like shitty downstairs neighbors. And they're like, fuck this. They're done.
They're just watching
We're flooding them.
The Office constantly. And you have to hear the theme song every day. They're fighting over rent.
Mm-hmm. Slamming doors, etc.
However, I will note that this flood only lasts 6 days and nights.
Look, I don't really care how long the flood is. If it kills everything on Earth, that's pretty much the point, right?
But then they're only on the boat for 6 days.
Well,
it's child's play.
They were chosen by God. Well, in the case of Gilgamesh and Utnapishtim, they survived due to their own cleverness.
Wiliness.
Yeah. But in Noah's case, he was chosen by God, and God chose to put him through that trial.
Did you know there's actually even in Greek mythology?
Yes, there is.
There's a story where Zeus decides to wipe out humanity with a flood.
Was it called the Deucalion? The
yes.
Deucarion?
Well, it's the Noah figure is Deucalion.
Deucalion.
He's Prometheus's son.
Mm.
And Prometheus gives him the heads up. He's like, yo, I heard some shit going down.
What did he hear from the frickin' vulture that's tearing his liver
yeah,
out every day?
Or whatever.
That would be so funny if they chatted, you know, like he was his nail technician, you know? Just be like, I heard while
like
he was tearing
those,
out his liver.
In those Looney Tunes cartoons where like the dog and the cat are chasing each other and then they like clock out.
Yeah,
or whatever.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But that one's a little less similar. They repopulate the earth by throwing bones and rocks over their shoulders.
Love it.
Anyway, shall we get into some of the exciting extra biblical material about Noah?
Yeah, absolutely. So I want to take us back. We're going to stop. We're going to rewind.
Okay.
And we're going to imagine a world before
all the way back in 1985.
It was the summer of 85. I think it sounded a little something like this. No, I want to talk about the pre-flood period because...
The antediluvian.
Indeed. Because extra textual stuff, and by that I mean like Midrash and the Talmud and stuff, mm-hmm. builds out this era a little bit.
And just to remind everybody, if you don't already know, the Midrashim and the Talmud are like different texts of like rabbinical commentary
yeah.
on the Bible as well as on like other like Jewish laws and stuff.
Yeah, and the earliest ones were oral traditions that were passed down.
The oral Torah, quote unquote, is the Mishnah.
And then later there were a bunch of extra stuff. The rabbis that are most famous and that I'll probably be like referencing the most were in the early BCs, early ADs,
mm-hmm.
if that makes sense. Yeah. CEs, excuse me. This is a
politically correct podcast.
That's right.
I always say AD because I think that when you say like BCE and CE, it sounds too similar.
It is phonetically confusing.
And the thing that's stupid is that we count it from Jesus' death, not that we put like Anno Domini, right? Like,
yeah, it does seem arbitrary that you would decide, oh, it's just a coincidence. That's the beginning of the common era.
Yeah, that's the common era. Like that doesn't actually decenter Christianity anyway. Anyway, continue on your journey to the past.
Yeah, to the past. So in our Enoch episode, we laid out the plot more comprehensively mm-hmm. of how the angels came down and why they came down and who were the instigators and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
And specifically, what secret gifts they gave to mankind, such as makeup and farming. And reading.
Yes, astrology as well.
Anyway, so I find it super fascinating, this antediluvian period, because it's apparently a time when the offspring of angels lived among men.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there was like an uneasy peace. And according to rabbinical commentary, this period of history after Adam and Eve left paradise, but before the flood, was just like a time of plenty. Like, people didn't live in cities. People didn't know how to farm.
Yeah.
People didn't have any conflict. They all spoke one language.
Well, they had a little bit of conflict because we got Cain and Abel.
That's true. That was the birth of conflict. And I gather it was a rare thing until the giants really started popping off.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, so this is a time when God provides for everything. Like, people don't have to do much. But still, with this abundance, things were corrupted. You know, things were getting out of control. They talk about this was being like a time of thievery and lust
mm-hmm.
and violence and stuff like that as the giants and the humans sort of came into conflict. And I think that's a very interesting setting and a very strange idea to have about a period of the world.
It is. We also know from the Book of Enoch that Noah himself was born radiant. He was shining. And his skin was very white and his blood was very red. And he's talked about in basically messianic terms. And he is kind of a messiah in that he ends the world and starts a new one.
True. I have the quote here.
Oh, yeah. Lay it on me.
So first of all, not only was he born radiant, but he was born circumcised.
Wow. Very advanced. Advanced penis.
And so this,
on Noah.
That quote is from a non-extant book. Called the Books of Noah.
Whoa.
There were fragments in the Dead Sea Scrolls, but it's also quoted extensively in the Book of Enoch. So a bunch of the stuff in Enoch about Noah was from this this text that we don't have anymore. We just have in fragmentary form. But one of the fragments that
this episode would have been so much better if we just had that frickin' book.
I know, baby. We got to dig in some frickin' caves.
We got to start digging.
We got to become spelunkers, baby. Biblical spelunkers. The Book of Noah describes him thus. His body was white as snow and red as the blooming of the rose, and the hair of his head and his long locks were white as wool, his eyes beautiful. He lighted up the whole house like a sun, and the whole house was very bright. Thereupon he rose in the hands of the midwife, opened his mouth, and conversed with the Lord of Righteousness. It's a classic baby rabbi situation.
Classic baby rabbi.
We've seen it so many times before. And then
we'll start with the Virgin Mary.
And then Lamech complains to Methuselah. He says, I have begotten a strange son, diverse from and unlike man, and resembling the sons of the God of heaven. And his nature is different, and he is not like us, and his eyes are the rays of the sun.
But he's not a fuck angel baby. Like,
I know.
Just want to make that
clear. The implication that jumps to my mind.
He's not a Nephil.
That he's like, you know, that his wife was maybe doing an angel on the side.
You also may remember that Raziel, the angel of secrets, gave Adam a sort of pre-Torah Torah.
Yes.
With like all the secrets of the universe mm-hmm. transcribed in like a sapphire. And supposedly this was passed down through the generations to Noah, and he had it hanging on the inside of the ark.
And also supposedly,
mm-hmm.
according to Rabbi, what's that one? Pirkei?
Mm-hmm. Pirkei de Eleazar.
There you go. Thank you. In that one, that's how Noah actually knows the dimensions by which to build the ark.
Hmm.
Because he's like, well, if he had access to the Torah, he would know the dimensions of the ark.
Whoa.
But isn't that a huge paradox?
That's a time paradox.
I love that.
That's crazy. But I think where we really start getting into the good stuff is on the ark. Because obviously, like, the ark is not a pleasant place to live for an entire year. And I appreciate that some rabbis tried to, like, put themselves in Noah's shoes.
Totally.
And imagine what that year was like. So it's very tight quarters, obviously. It's a big boat, but it's carrying...
It's packed with beasts.
It's carrying all the animals that exist and enough food for all of them.
Mm-hmm. And a wide variety of food as well.
Yes. And so he's got to... Yeah, Noah's got to, like... First, he's got to keep the prey and the predators separated.
Mm-hmm.
Because he can't have, you know, the lions
just
eating
like the
all the giraffes.
Just like the offering said those many years ago.
He also has to have, yeah, like food for lions as well as food for giraffes. It's a, you know, he's got to have like acacia trees on the ark. One story says he gets swiped by a lion for feeding it late. And he walks with a limp for the rest of his life.
That's right. He drinks to excess to
numb
cover
the
pain from that
interesting.
Injury.
The ark is three stories tall, it says in Genesis. It's a triple decker. The medieval rabbi...
You sounded like you wanted to drop there. Like it's just like one of our classic triple deckers. It's a triple decker, decker, decker.
Decker, decker. The medieval rabbi Rashi says that the lower deck was used just for excrement. I'm not sure why they couldn't just toss that... off the side into the giant worldwide flood.
Yes.
But, you know.
Rashi says some wild stuff.
One of us is a great rabbi and one of us is not. So if one of us says Noah's Ark was weighed down with thousands of pounds of animal shit, you know, I trust him.
Yeah, it's like a leave it like you found it situation.
Yeah, yeah.
They didn't want to pollute God's new sea.
Fair enough.
But early rabbis suggested that the Ark, because of its mystical origins... contained, you know, it was like a pocket dimension and it was infinitely
okay.
large.
That makes sense. Like the internal dimensions exceed the external. It's
yes.
like House of Leaves.
I've never read it.
That's okay. I haven't either. So because of the many delicious varieties of shit mm-hmm. on the Ark, Noah and his family start to get new and exciting diseases that have never been encountered by humanity before.
I don't know this.
But not to worry, because an angel takes Shem on a quick trip up to heaven, and he receives the Book of Medicines, and that is what all future medical knowledge is based on, including everything the ancient Greeks came up with.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. Also, neither humans nor animals are allowed to fuck, because it would just be rude.
Well, also, God made a rule. Everything that gets on the boat has got to come off the boat. No more, no less.
Mm. I thought it was just, you know, everyone else is like being brutally killed. So it would just harsh
be
the
in
vibe.
Bad taste.
Yeah, it would just be in bad taste.
I think it's just sea law.
It's ancient maritime law.
Well, but you mentioned the rabbis putting themselves in Noah's shoes. And an example of that I love is that they explained how Noah and his sons barely slept the entire year because one animal would need to be fed at midnight and the next at 2 a.m. and the next at 3 a.m. and
oh,
the next
of course.
At 4 a.m.
Animals have different times of day when they're active.
So they never slept.
You got to get the crepuscular ones,
mm-hmm.
the diurnal, the nocturnal.
Of course.
Hmm. But couldn't they like take shifts? I mean, there's four men and four women.
But there are so many species of animals,
that's
right?
True. Yeah, that's true. Speaking of species of animals, the flood is traditionally a very convenient way to kind of close the door on antediluvian mythical beasts.
Mm-hmm.
Because like these early stories in Genesis, they're really, really ancient, right? And they're not like really fleshed out enough.
Yeah, they're
to,
not
like,
really like consistent with the rest of
yeah.
the...
Yeah. They're not consistent even internally, let alone yeah. with like the rest of the Bible. And so the flood is like a really convenient way to like close all those threads.
Right.
So if you're like, well, you know, if God created the Garden of Eden and Genesis 2:14 says that the Tigris and Euphrates rivers flow from the Garden of Eden. Mm-hmm. Like, why can't I go find it?
Right.
You know? And the answer is just like, oh, well, the flood wiped it out. Jews who were exposed to Greek culture, like, adopted the idea of the centaur or other Greek mythological animals. But then they were like, oh, yeah, like that makes sense. I can imagine, like, a horse-man combination. But, you know, the flood wiped them out.
Yeah. And one of the things the flood did wipe out is the giants.
The giants,
that
yes.
was, like, one of the main points with was the flood wiping out all the giants. However, the rabbis say in Pirkei Eleazar that Noah warned the giants, that the giants saw it coming, saw the flood coming.
Because they were so tall?
Not specifically, although, here's the quote. If the flood should come, it could not harm us. We are too tall. And moreover, we could close up with our feet the springs from below.
Mm.
Then, according to, again, Pirkei Rabbi Eleazar, when God started to flood the world and they started to close the springs, because it not only fell from the sky, but it came up from the ground.
Yes.
When they started to close the springs with their feet, he heated up the water to boiling temperatures.
Yes.
So the giants had to jump into the air. And then so the giants were so upset by this, they started throwing their children at the springs to try and clog the springs up. That's how monstrous they were.
Oh, my God.
But it wasn't good enough to close up the springs.
So I read that actually the reason that, like, the water was boiling mm-hmm. was because it had been burned in the fires of Gehenna. It had been boiled in, like, hell, basically. And it was, like, hellfire raining down on all the sinners.
So there's even another conversation from a Midrash. Noah was asked when he was talking with the giants about the flood, what kind of flood was going to be coming. If a flood of fire, they had a fire animal, Alita, the name of which would act as a spell against fire. If of water, they had sheets of iron to cover the springs.
Oh, but it was both. So what are you going to do then?
But in case the waters descended above, they had another contrivance by which to escape, the Akolb, or Akosh, a.k.a. the humble sponge.
The humble sponge!
So the giants had a whole plan. It didn't work, though.
I also read that, so, like, Genesis 2 says that, like, it didn't rain in the Garden of Eden.
Mm-hmm.
There was just, like, a self-watering mist.
Sure.
So that...
It sounds lovely.
I know, doesn't it? So this rain might be, like, the first rain that's ever existed.
Oh, wow.
So then the giants, like, don't even know what to expect.
I like that, too.
But there was one giant that survived. And we know he survived because he's in the canonical Bible.
Mm-hmm.
He's in the book of Deuteronomy. And he is named Og. He's not one of the Nephilim. He's one of the Rephaim, which is a different type of giant. Unclear what kind of fuck spirit produced the Rephaim.
Yeah.
And in Deuteronomy...
They seem to be less chaotic than their,
Nephilite
brothers.
They do seem to be less of a problematic fave. Moses' army defeats the giant Og,
mm-hmm.
king of Bashan, as part of their military campaign to take over the Promised Land. And it says in Deuteronomy that he's the last of the Rephaim, and his bed was 9 cubits long by 4 cubits wide. Which is about 13 by 6 feet or so. You may be wondering, of course, if the flood wiped out all these giants, how did Og survive to Moses' time, generations mm-hmm. later? So there is a legend that accounts for this, where Og swore to be a servant to Noah and his family forever if they would let him hitch a ride on the ark.
Mm-hmm.
So he sat on top. And Noah bored a little hole in the ceiling so he could pass food up through it. Not sure. It seems like that might be a little risky with the rain situation, but it seemed to all work out for the best.
One thing I'd like you to note about Og. The Torah says, only Noah and those with him in the ark survived. If you take the Hebrew words, only Noah, and add up their numerical value, you get 79. I'll bet you can guess what other word has the numerical value of 79. O-G.
What has the numerical value of 69?
I don't know. I don't know anything about numerology. By the way, if you want to read a very strange little piece called The Memoirs of Og.
Oh my God.
I strongly recommend heading over to Chabad.org.
Oh my God. I didn't know about this.
Because they have a very cute narrative version of a description of Og and his life in the Bible.
He's usually portrayed as like an enemy, but he does have this cute childlike moment where he just rides on top of the ark.
Yeah. But I mean, his story is amazing, right? I mean, he like survived the flood, but he wasn't one of God's chosen.
And he's still alive generations later.
Yeah.
Way after Noah.
Yeah.
Way after Shem and Ham and Japheth.
By the way, did you know that Noah only lived 950 years because he gave 50 to Moses?
Oh, that was kind of him.
Yeah. Adam also apparently gave 50 years to Moses.
Wow. Should we take a break?
Yeah, let's take 50 years of our own. And by that, I mean 1 minute or so. You're going to hear some music, and then we'll be back with more Noah, more Lauren, more Nico, all your friends on the couch. And we'll see you in a couple. Bye-bye.
Okay.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Welcome back to Sunday School Dropouts. My name is Nico.
I'm Lauren.
And my wife is laughing at me.
I'm not laughing.
She laughed at me.
I didn't laugh.
I'm embarrassed.
We are talking about Noah. You know him from the Bible. But extra biblical stories about Noah.
Where's he at in his journey? He's on the boat.
Yeah.
He's about to land, honestly.
We're saying that, yeah, he's landed. He's been stranded on Mount Ararat.
Mm-hmm.
And he's got to send out some birds. So he sends out a raven first. And like I said earlier, it's kind of ambiguous. It says the raven flies back and forth, but it's not clear whether Noah sees the raven and understands that it can't land anywhere, or if it's just like a bad tool for this particular job.
Oh, also, raven is an unclean bird.
The raven is an unclean bird. And so according to legend, the raven was very unhappy about being sent out. Because there's only one breeding pair on
right.
the ark.
Mm-hmm.
There's seven of doves, for example, because they're clean. And so the raven is like, you know, what if I get hurt? Then ravens will go extinct.
Are you okay with that?
Extinct? Are you trying to get with my wife?
A great question.
Why do you hate me? Why are you making me do this? And... But Noah makes him do it anyway. Now, personally, I think there's a loophole here because Genesis does say seven of each type of clean animal and seven of each type of bird.
That's right.
It doesn't say clean versus unclean birds.
Not both versions of this story, because the story occurs twice in Genesis.
Yeah, well, that happens a bit in Genesis. But I think there's a loophole. Again, I'm not a learned rabbi, you know, renowned through the centuries for his sagacity, but I think there's a loophole.
According to commentary also, even in versions of this story where Noah didn't have the magic time-traveling Torah.
Engraved in a sapphire?
Yes. He knew the unclean animals from the clean because when he started to round up animals, the clean ones bowed to him.
Oh, interesting.
As if they were little temple deer in Japan or something like that.
That's very cute.
But the unclean ones, of course, would not bow because he's not, I mean, what does he mean to them?
Right. You know? I did also read that the animals all came to him willingly.
Yes.
Because, you know, he wouldn't have been able to round up every species.
No.
That would be too many.
He's not some sort of magical hunter, although he did live 500 years before the flood.
That's true.
But we're past that. Apologies for interrupting and sending us flying back into the distant past.
Much like a raven. flying back and forth until the waters recede.
I see.
Also, one story says that it flies to and fro until it finds a delicious bloated corpse.
That's right.
Because, yeah, ravens feed on carrion. So it just has to find one floating dead human killed in the flood.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's just going to go to town. So after all these birds have flown to and fro.
After all the bird business.
We get the rainbow. And there is debate among the rabbis who wrote all these biblical commentaries about whether the rainbow existed before Noah's time or whether God invented it right there on the spot. So some say it was created when God strengthened the sun after the flood, I guess.
To dry up the water?
To burn up the water
or
something.
God uses science. We all know that.
Yeah, this is, if there's one thing you can say about the story of Noah's Ark, very scientific. Some say God created the rainbow, you know, during the original 7 days of creation, but he hid it in the clouds and no humans had seen it until now.
Mm-hmm.
You're not supposed to stare straight at the rainbow because the Shekinah appears in it.
What?
Yes.
You could hurt your eyes.
Yes. She's clothed in yellow, red, and white garments.
I guess the rest of the spectrum just isn't for her.
It's, you know, she's just taken some of it, but you're not supposed to look straight at it.
Oh, by the way, according to rabbis, the entire world flooded, but Israel did not.
What?
To be clear.
But what?
Apparently, Israel did not flood.
Wow, good for Israel.
Of course, Noah and the previous generations were not living anywhere near Israel.
I guess. They were living in Turkey.
Yeah.
Near Mount Ararat.
Yeah. That's the only explanation that some people have. Like, how could it be? Why would he flood the promised land or something like that? Anyway, Israel didn't flood.
It is also said that during the generation of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, who was kind of the original Kabbalah guy, like back in the second century, during his lifetime, no rainbows ever appeared because he was a tzaddik, or righteous man. So he was basically a living rainbow himself.
Wow.
Because the rainbow is like a sign of God's mercy.
Yeah.
But the righteous man is also a sign of God's mercy. So you don't even need the rainbow. It's redundant.
Speaking of tzaddik, and this will key in with what Noah does when he lands.
Yeah.
And the first steps he takes.
The sacrifice.
There are, well, not only the sacrifice, but his future career as a vintner.
Mm.
There was a ton of discussion in rabbinical writings about whether Noah was actually, like, a good person. Like, whether he was, like, an actually righteous man or not.
Yes, I saw some of that because the debate is kind of like, okay, so he lived during a very sinful generation.
Right.
He was, like, the only righteous one in this generation, but does that mean, like, okay, he was more righteous than the others, but, like, compared to a real generation, he wouldn't be that good.
Right, because in Genesis 6:9, it says...
Yeah, 69.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It describes him as a just man and perfect in his generation.
Hmm.
So people looked at some of his actions, specifically in also in rabbinical commentary, there's a lot of stuff about him doubting, like waiting until the water was thigh high before getting in the ark.
Whoa. Damn. You know?
It's not like he was getting in the ark early because mm-hmm. he was sure the flood was coming. He was waiting until the water was thigh high before he got in the ark.
There is always like a lot of dramatization in like pop culture representations where like, oh, his neighbors are laughing at him because he's building this giant boat even though they live in the middle of the desert.
Right.
You know, none of that is actually in Genesis. But...
No, but in the commentaries, sometimes he's building it for 120 years.
Yes.
And that he planted the cedar forests. In the commentaries, it's cedar. He planted the cedar forest that he would eventually harvest to make the ark, and all the while telling all of his neighbors what he was doing to prepare for this great flood.
So actually, that's interesting because in Islam, he has a fourth son.
Oh, he does. The fourth son.
And the fourth son is not a true believer.
Mm.
And he refuses to get on the ark.
See, that's a great way to improve the story.
It's a great twist. He says, if it rains, I'll just go up. I'll go up high on a mountain and avoid the flood. And he does climb up on a mountain, but he gets drowned. And also his name is Yam, which is pretty similar to Ham. Seems like some notes got mixed up there.
Yeah, but maybe.
He's also a lot more active in the Quran.
Mm.
He's out there like, he's a prophet.
Yeah.
And he's preaching and he's trying to get people to listen to his message.
Right.
And repent before this flood. In the Bible,
he's pretty passive in the Bible.
It doesn't really say anything about his opinions or anything. He builds the boat and he gets on it.
No, but that's what makes him a rich vessel for Midrashim, for commentary and for extra stories and stuff like that. Because in the Bible, his story is extremely evocative, but somewhat vaguely sketched, you know?
Yes. Also, so I think it's interesting that there's this Jewish historian, Josephus, right?
Mm-hmm. Flavius.
Flavius Josephus.
Flavius the Flavor Josephus.
Who was like a Romanized Jew and was writing like kind of shortly after Jesus's life. And he makes Noah kind of in the middle. He's kind of semi-active in a way that I find really funny because he says that Noah's like trying to preach to the Nephilim because he, quote, was very uneasy at what they did. And then he tries to convert them. But when they don't convert, he's afraid they'll kill him. And so he just moves to a different area.
Which is funny because like at this point, God doesn't have an organized religion.
Right.
Like in the antediluvian period, it's before organized religion.
Right, but it's just monotheism. That's the deal. You're not supposed to worship idols.
Yeah, but God doesn't even have any rules before the flood.
Yeah.
Noah's the first person he makes a deal with. You know?
Yeah, he is. He makes the covenant with him. And that's...
But maybe it was like a communication problem. Like he expected everybody to follow the Noahite rules.
Well, yeah.
Which are a different thing.
So there
actually is
the Noahid laws.
Yeah.
And that's kind of expanding on, you know, I mentioned there was like, he signs the covenant with a rainbow and that covenant includes a few rules. And those are called the Noahid laws or the seven laws of Noah. And they're truly only like three or four in the actual Bible. But commentary has expanded them into seven. And it's like don't eat blood or living creatures and like don't murder and try murderers in court. And then there's a couple more. There's like idolatry.
You can't graft trees in a city?
You can't graft trees in a city? That's one of the seven like laws that everybody has to obey?
I may be getting that wrong. There is one that does involve grafting trees.
Damn.
Though. That is an important part of it. But I'm not sure what it's about.
The other thing Josephus does that I find funny is that he goes out of his way to, like, he's writing for, like, a Roman audience.
Mm-hmm.
And so he goes out of his way to explain why people lived longer, like, why Noah could be 950 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, okay, A of all, creation was new and, like, food was more nutritious. B, God had just invented humans and he wanted them to, like, live longer. And then C, they needed to live longer so they could like figure out astronomy and like crop rotation, stuff that takes like generations to figure out. So God let them figure that out.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like before writing, you would need extremely long lifespans to assemble like generational knowledge.
Yeah, exactly.
Sure, Flavio.
Yeah. The last thing I want to cover is, everybody's everybody's favorite segment of the show, what's the deal with ham?
Mm-hmm.
Why is it such a big deal that Noah's son saw him naked? It seems like if anyone's in the wrong here, it's Noah. He's the one who got too drunk and passed out naked.
Naked.
But he was in his own tent. I mean, it's kind of...
Can't a man pass out drunk in his own tent?
I feel like it's kind of a victimless crime. So I was surprised to learn that a very common rabbinic theory is that Ham didn't just look at his dad naked. He took advantage. Yeah. He took advantage of him being passed out drunk to either castrate him or sodomize him.
Yeah.
Quote unquote.
Right.
That seems like such a modern take on it that I was really surprised to learn that that's like what rabbis came up with in the year 500.
Well, I mean, if you look at the text, the text in Genesis is so vague.
It is very vague. And it's like, why is this such a big deal? It does seem to be...
He curses Ham's line forever.
Yes.
And that's like pretty early on in humanity, right? So it's kind of like a foundational curse.
Yes.
The only bigger one is Cain and Abel.
Right. Which, by the way...
created vampires.
No, that's not what I was going to say.
Okay.
You know, Cain, after murdering Abel, is condemned to be a ceaseless wanderer on the earth.
Yeah, like a fucking vamp.
And so there is an interpretation that, like, he couldn't die because that would make his wandering, like, cease.
Yeah, so he's a freaking vampire.
But then he gets killed by the flood. Very convenient.
Now he just walks along the ground.
Just underwater.
Yeah, sucking the blood out of fishes and whatnot.
There's
I've seen
a You'll love to see it.
You'd love to see it.
There's a slightly less provocative theory about the curse of Ham, which is that basically what Ham should have done when he went in the tent and saw that dong a dingin.
Right.
He
again circumcised at birth.
Circumcised at birth. Magnificent penis. He should have looked away and covered it up, you know, like his brothers eventually did, and he shouldn't have gone and told his brothers about it so that there were more witnesses to Noah's shame.
Right.
As a myth, you know, it seems clear. Like the objectives of the myth seem clear, right? It's like, you know, you're supposed to obey and respect your parents even if they fuck up.
Yes.
And, you know, invent viticulture a little too early, say. It also, of course, justifies...
Fuck around and accidentally invent
might fuck around and invent viticulture. It also, of course, justifies the Israelites being enemies with all the tribes that are supposedly descended from Ham.
Right, because then you're stuck in this position where everybody is descended from the same family, so like... And we know that people now kill each other.
Right. And so it's like
protecting your family line is the most important thing. So how do you justify that, right?
Also, like, the Old Testament describes very atrocious acts against, you know, when Moses's big old band of Israelites
retake the Holy Land.
Retake the Promised Land. I mean, they literally kill men, women, and children.
Yeah.
And they're like Canaanites and Philistines, all these people who are supposedly descended from Ham. And so any human that, like, is killing children feels bad. And society's come up with justifications for that. So this is, like, one possible justification for that.
But it's a very... I mean, they should have made it more explicit.
I mean... Yeah. So, but what's interesting to
me... And not more explicit, like, with three X's.
I mean, it's already pretty explicit with the dick. What's interesting to me is that... You're saying, like, okay, that's not, like, a good justification. That's, like, that's like pretty weak sauce. But people continue to use that passage across cultures and continents and centuries into the very recent past. This is what we were alluding to at the beginning of the show, because eventually Europeans and, like, white Americans decided that African people are the descendants of Ham, and that justifies making them slaves.
Right, because Noah not only invented... getting absolutely sauced, he invented slavery.
Yeah, he says specifically that the descendants of Ham should be the slaves of the other two. And so that was very commonly used as a biblical justification for slavery. And even more recently, that was used in the Mormon church to justify black people not getting full rights.
Because you can't let people with the curse of Ham in?
Yep.
Oh, my Lord.
So, like, black people could join the church, but, you know, in, like, in Mormonism, the men get to be, like every man is a priest.
They get ranked.
Yeah, they get, like, ranked. But so black men couldn't, like, they could join, but they couldn't be, like, they couldn't have the status of men.
So they couldn't go through, like, the special rituals and get promoted and
Yeah,
stuff.
Or whatever. I mean, I don't.
And they certainly couldn't be, like, elders or whatever.
Exactly. Yeah. I don't really know the details. But, and that was, like, until very, very recently, right? Mm. Like, when Mitt Romney ran for president, he talked about, you know, he had this story about hearing that black people were finally allowed in, and he was, like, crying of joy or whatever. So that was, like, you know, just in the past couple decades.
Yeah.
It's very interesting to me that humanity has changed so little that, like, it's been 3,000 years or whatever since this story was, like, probably more since the original story was written.
Yeah.
And people still use these same exact text to justify the same exact thing, but with, like, ethnicities that don't even exist in the Bible. There's no white people and black people in the Bible. Like,
right.
Those aren't.
No.
Those aren't races in the Bible, but, like, we can still use that myth in the exact same way that it was used. That's very interesting to me.
I mean, it really makes the case for the Bible as a living, like, human document.
It's that, like, that the Constitution.
No, it's not a living document like that. I mean, well, in some traditions it is. In Judaism it is. It's a living document.
Well, some forms of Judaism.
Agreed. In some, it stopped in the 15th century. So this is somewhat related to that. I mentioned briefly earlier how rabbis are not or were not sure in the time when they were writing important Midrashim and whatnot whether Noah was a good man or not. Do you know what Noah's name is from?
No. In Hebrew, it's Noach. But I don't know what it's from.
It's supposedly some, and again, I will have to defer to you on this one, obviously, but it's some derivation of to rest or to be at rest.
Okay.
So that has been a poetic touch point for a lot of people in thinking about Noah.
Hmm.
So, for example, rabbis suggested that he was called that because he was the first person to invent a plow, and he was the first person to plow the earth.
Yes, I have read that he invented farming implements.
Right. So he sort of represents the human transition between a, like, nomadic or gathering
Oh, like hunter-gatherers into agriculture.
Into agriculture.
That, I really like that because, as I've mentioned previously on the podcast, I kind of like to think of Adam and Eve as, like, this weird genetic memory of, like, before we evolved into, like, Homo sapiens per se, when we were just, like, naked in the wild and, like, didn't know anything.
Right.
And that, like, the idea of the tree of knowledge, the fruit of the tree of knowledge is kind of like, oh, suddenly the species gained language and now we know things and it's really weird.
Yeah. So one thing I've heard proposed, which I thought was very interesting, was the idea of Adam and Eve in paradise is the idea of being perpetually in a single moment without having any idea of future or past.
Mindfulness.
Because you can never be worried and you can never dwell on anything bad that's ever happened.
And that's what happens when you don't have language, by the way.
Yeah, you do. It's very difficult to maintain
Consult
a future and a past.
Lauren Marx's memoir about having brain damage and having aphasia.
Mm.
And she lost all but 40 words. And she was like, yeah, when I only had 40 words, I was the least anxious. Like, there was no anxiety because I didn't have words to form that stuff.
But then when the old world is destroyed, when the hunter-gatherer world is destroyed and an agricultural world is born, that's Noah. That's bringing people to rest is one interpretation of it.
I love that.
Do you think it's time to rate this fellow?
I suppose we can rate this little man.
Okay. How would you rate this book, my dear?
I'm gonna give it, I think, 6 out of 7 boat hopping giants.
Nice.
Well, first of all, I really actually surprisingly enjoyed rereading the Noah story just in Genesis.
Mm-hmm.
And seeing all the details that usually get left out.
Yeah.
obviously we covered that in our like very first episode, but we didn't have time to like go into detail.
It's a thing that just comes to my mind occasionally when making this show, is that like it's too bad.
So much stuff is in Genesis.
It's very natural that our first episode was Genesis, right?
Yeah.
However, it's also kind of too bad that our first episode was Genesis. What if we had done it in reverse? Would that be wild?
That's what we're going to... Season 4, we're just doing it in reverse.
Please don't say that out loud.
So I enjoyed that. And then I very much enjoyed all the folktale additions.
Mm-hmm.
I love any type of wacky folktale additions to myths. Also, I just think, Claude Levi-Strauss said that myths are good to think with.
Hmm.
And I think that the myth of Noah is really interesting. Like, we're talking about, oh, that's when humans gained agriculture.
Mm-hmm.
Or like, oh, that's that like justifies slavery.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's just a really powerful story somehow, for better or for worse. Obviously, for worse in the case of slavery. But... just very interested in how tenacious this story has been and how many cultures it's crossed and how many centuries and geographical thousands of miles.
Mm-hmm.
Very interesting to me. What would you rate it?
I would give it 8 out of 9 rabbinical interpolations.
Okay.
And for a lot of the same reasons. It's super fascinating. To me, it reminds me most of the stories of the apocalypse.
Mm-hmm.
That recur in a lot of traditions and in Jewish and Christian literature all over the place.
Yeah, it is about the world ending.
It's about the world ending. And I think, like always with apocalypse stuff, it's actually about confronting any radical change. The one that looms large in everyone's life is, of course, death.
Mm-hmm.
That
don't like it, don't want to think about it.
That's right. But the idea is that maybe... you know, when the rest of the world is destroyed, a.k.a. your consciousness is destroyed, you'd be carried by God to the other side, to a new world.
Mm-hmm.
So, I don't know. I mean, that's just one way to interpret it, which means that shit's got legs, baby.
Yeah.
You know? It's got guns. And it's not afraid to use them.
Wow.
And by that, I mean, it's a powerful...
it's going to shoot you.
...myth.
In the face.
Even though in the Bible, there are two versions of it which conflict slightly and are... very confusing.
That happens a lot in the Bible.
When you think about it, those two stories are like two versions of the same story from hundreds of years apart.
Yeah,
so
they
it's
are.
Actually so it's actually cool that there are two versions of it.
It's combining different oral traditions, and then like, you know, the one in the Epic of Gilgamesh is a slightly different one.
Yeah, from like 500 years before the oldest Bible one, probably.
Yeah.
So like, it's actually good that there are multiple versions of the story, and it should be a moment of education about how important stories can get retold and get changed slightly and can still have value in both forms, which is the best part of the Bible to me, honestly, in some ways.
That's the power. Yeah, that's the power of the Bible.
Right.
Is that people read it and they use it as like a mythological tool or as an ideological tool. And that can be done in so many, infinitely many ways.
And the Bible is not just that tool, but it is an example of that usage. In
yeah.
the fact that it has thousands of years of that embedded within it.
Yeah.
So.
To suck on that.
Yeah. So if you don't mind, kind listener, suck on that.
Or should we slash open the mailbag and spill its sweet contents all over the studio?
I would love to, my dear.
Listener Dave wrote in with a picture of a, frankly, kick-ass tattoo with a line from Song of Songs in Irish. Don't know how to pronounce the Irish because Irish spelling makes even less sense than English, believe it or not. In English, it's, it's until the day breaks and the darkness flees. In the original Hebrew, Dave, if you care to learn, it's Ad sheyafuch hayom v'nasu hatzlalim.
A couple people also wrote in about our last episode on the apocalypse of Abraham to tell us that the substance that the Syrian traders were traveling to Egypt for, cochineal, is probably actually cochineal.
Or which, like cochineal.
Cochineal. Like cochlear.
Okay.
Which is a type of red dye. And I remember when you and I were in San Antonio.
Yes. We used to live in Austin,
in the great
Texas.
State of Texas, close to my heart,
uh-huh.
as always. At the Alamo, they talked all about trapping little beetles to make some sort of red dye.
Yes. So apparently that's how they made cochineal.
Which is very confusing because it's like it's an old world name for a new world thing.
Yeah, maybe there was a previous red dye, whatever.
Wow, somebody's not interested in going to the etymology corner?
No, it's just, I'm not
interested. No, it's okay,
Here's what I'm not interested in, the entomology corner.
Oh, she don't like the bugs.
We also got an email from a fellow ex-presbo named Michael, who is requesting a blessing for his beloved dog, Lady Jane Grey, who recently passed away at age 16. He sent pictures and she's a very cute little friend. I think she's maybe a Westie. And Michael, you and I actually have something else in common besides both being ex-presbos. Because when I worked at a pet store, I wanted to name the shop cat Lady Jane Grey after the cat in Bleak House. I don't know if that's who your dog is named after. But my boss ended up naming the cat Louise, which of course now seems like the perfect name that
she would only ever be.
She was born Louise. Yeah. God bestowed that name on her. But Michael, you have very good taste in pet names.
And tremendous respect to a great friend.
Charles Dickens. Oh, and Lady Jane Grey.
Here's a blessing for Lady Jane Grey. And as often as I saw, I blessed always Lady Jane Grey, and I continued to bless Lady Jane Grey, who has wrought great and glorious wonders to show the greatness of her work to the angels and to spirits and to men, that they might praise her.
R.I.P.
That'll do it for today's episode of Sunday School Dropouts. It's number 100. We've completed a single hundo.
We did a hundo.
And we're proud and very happy and extremely thankful to all of you for listening, because otherwise, look, it simply doesn't work.
It just doesn't work.
So, I don't know, this is...
So it's like, you know, thanks and stuff.
It's just a simple...
I don't know.
A simple thank you, a simple I love you to my wife.
Okay, thanks.
And a simple I also love you to all our listeners.
Okay, I'm not as jazzed about that.
It sounds a little bit hollow to say it, but you can follow us on Twitter at SunSchoolDrop.
You can follow me on Twitter at Lauren E. O'Neill. O'Neill spelled with an A, like Ark.
You can follow me on Twitter at Niko Bakulich, N-I-K-O-B-A-K-U-L-I-C-H.
We would also super, 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 super appreciate if for a 100th episode birthday gift.
That's right.
You
the
might,
100th anniversary is the Super Diamond anniversary or the iTunes review anniversary.
The iTunes review anniversary. And we would appreciate if you got on there and gave us 5 stars, just like Chibi Silverwings, who called us, quote, great biblical lit crit, which personally, as an English major and MFA in creative writing holder,
and famously modest person,
that's my dream, really,
is to be great biblical lit crit.
To be great lit crit of any type.
If you want to email us, send us pictures of your pets or dogs.
Dogs don't count as pets because they're humans.
That's right. You can do so by emailing us at contact@sundayschooldropouts.lol.
That's contact@sundayschooldropouts.lol. Do not type .com. Simply
don't. That is actually where all the giants went. They're having a big party and they didn't invite you.
You won't like it there unless you do. Of course, we always thank Elise Carlton for our amazing logo. And I would like to thank Niko for his music, sound engineering, and simply his editing skills.
You're welcome, my dear. I want to thank Lauren for being a tremendous 100 episode podcast co-host.
That's me.
We'll be back in 2 weeks.
101, baby.
Simply, I think we're breaking off a fresh hundo.
Wow. We're snapping off a new bill.
It's going to be crisp as shit. We'll see you then. Okay, I love you. Bye.
Okay, bye.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.